I was just reminded as I was sitting down there of a Meister Eckhart, who's a spiritual writer and teacher in some centuries ago. He said that the spiritual life begins with subtraction. And I think in the first talk, talking about the younger son, there was a stripping away of things that he thought were going to give him life, but he found that they didn't. And he changes his mind and changes his direction and moves back towards home, whereas Ben suggested that verse about the father ran to meet him and hugged him and kissed him. And in this, what I've said so far about Rembrandt, there was a real stripping away of all the things that he held precious. But it was the beginning of a deeper seeing and understanding truth. And I think in our lives, often God has to strip away things that we've lent on and put all our weight upon that don't actually provide the answer that we are most deeply looking for. Well, let's turn back to the elder brother. And Tim Keller's two questions. How was the elder brother alienated from the father? And how did he seek acceptance into his kingdom? It's quite a powerful question, really. How was he alienated from his father? We've seen quite clearly how the younger brothers rebelled against his father and ran away and was funded for his escapade by the generosity of his father, but came back. The elder brother's at home all the time. The elder brother doesn't live dangerously. He's a responsible and dutiful son. Perhaps the parents would be proud of him. If we had children like that, we might be proud of them. But he can't understand the miracle of conversion that was evident in his younger brother, but was evident in some of the tax collectors and sinners who were in the crowd when Jesus was teaching this parable. And he's acutely angered, enraged by the father's behavior in receiving and making such a fuss of his younger brother. And he sees the father's acceptance of him and restoring to him honor and his position in the family. He sees that as totally unjust. And if we're like the elder brother, we see perhaps new people who might come into the church whose lives perhaps have been in a mess and get a lot of attention and favor. We feel, why didn't I get that? And that's the elder brother syndrome. Now, the way the elder brother speaks to his father about his younger brother is really marked by jealousy and bitterness, resentment, and even contempt for his father. And in portraying the elder brother, Jesus is mindful of these scribes and the Pharisees, the religious leaders of the day. And I think he's really challenging them, the people who are his strongest antagonists. Like them, when the elder brother heard from the servants that his young brother had returned and been reinstated by the father, they would have been furious. And the elder brother's words reveal what's actually buried in his heart. It's clear that the older brother resented his father's authority and really tries to take control and tell his father what he was to do. So here I've put, while the younger brother was separated from his father by his bad deeds, the older brother was separated by his father from his father by his good deeds, his self-righteousness. So his attempt to enter the kingdom of heaven was by a scrupulous keeping of the law, almost to make his father owe him something. I've done all these things for you, keeping the law, being kind, generous. I've done all these things for you. Surely, God, you owe me something. And religious people often think like that. They, in some ways, resent outsiders coming in and getting the attention. God, you owe me something. Both brothers wanted their father's things, not their father. So they have that in common. His attempt to enter the kingdom of heaven was by a scrupulous keeping of the law that would make his father owe him something. And that's the default position of elder brothers and sisters, is to get things from God by dutiful obedience rather than humbly receiving a gift. Now, the younger brother is a model to us of how to approach God. He comes with penitence. He owns his rebellion, confesses his rebellion, and yet he lets the Father do all sorts of things to him. He receives his embrace. He lets him reinstate him. So both sons sought to displace the authority of the Father in their own lives. And that lies at the heart of sin. I want something else to fill my life. I don't want God to reign over me. And that's what some people said when Jesus was around. So both brothers are equally alienated from their father. Both are lost, but one becomes aware of it through a stripping away of things that he invested everything in. The elder brother and the scribes remain blind to their rebellion. The elder brother has a strong sense of moral superiority, and he gains significance by comparing himself to his younger brother. If you listen to his words, he's harsh and judging and ready to believe the worst about his brother. This son of yours who has devoured your property with prostitutes. How did he know that? Was it a postcard from his younger brother? I doubt it. You see, he suspected the worst about him, where his father believed the best. So he's quick to condemn. He's unforgiving. And sadly, the older brother, like many churchgoers, live their life out of fear rather than experiencing the joy and love which the younger brother had opened himself to receive. Now it's the elder brother's turn to disgrace his father. When his father comes out with him to plead him to come into the feast, his refusal is really a vote of no confidence in his father's action. This older brother is outraged by outrageous grace and in seeing his father reinstate his younger brother into the family and making him an heir again with a claim to a third of the diminished family wealth. So the older brother saw his inheritance contracting because of the father's great generosity. The older brother was very miffed and told his father exactly what he thought. Now, Lewis Smedes, in a book entitled Shame and Grace, Opposites, imagines a conversation between the father and the elder brother, which might have gone something like this. "That rotten kid doesn't deserve all this. Why do you throw such a lavish celebration for them? Why, for that matter, do you let him back into the family at all?" He wanted to push him out, to treat him like a leper. And the father's reply, Smead suggests, is, "You're right, son, he does not deserve it. But if only you knew him like I know him, you would know he is worthy to be my son. The fellow he became for a while out in the far country was not his true self. And that true self is worthy to be my son." So the deepest tragedy of the older brother in this story, and the deepest tragedy of many nominal Christians, many churchgoers, is they lack assurance. They don't know how much their father loves him. "You never threw me a party," is what he says. Now, even though grace accepts me in spite of what I am, with all my shadows and all my darkness and all my fears, it also accepts me for who I am. I'm a unique creature of extraordinary worth. And that's true of every one of us. That's how God sees us. A unique creature of extraordinary worth. So there's a yawning gap between the elder brother and the father. For one, what matters most is what his younger brother has squandered. Whereas for the father, what matters most is that he's regained his lost son. And as long as we try to earn our salvation by controlling God through our goodness, "I've done all this for you, you owe me, you owe me, you owe me," we'll never be sure that we've been good enough. And we can end up with a dry, dutiful, but joyless relationship with the Father, and very little awareness of his delight in us. This manifests itself in a drivenness to find our identity in our achievements. I think it's fascinating in our age today how everybody is trying to discover their true identity. If they're not content with the biological sex, they will go trans. It's almost frantic search for something that makes me believe I'm worth something. And we might find our identity in perhaps the roles we play in life, in business, the achievements we've succeeded in, or we might find a role in church is meaningful. Now, I think that's true, but beware of putting your identity in your role. A great youth worker said lots of young people come up to him and say, "Who am I? Who am I? Where do I find my identity?" And his answer was, "You'll never find the answer by asking the question, who am I? You'll find the answer by asking the question, whose am I?" And the younger son came back and found the father said, "This is my beloved son." And I think the deepest answer to our identity is that we are loved by God and accepted by God. So there are really two ways of finding fulfillment. The younger son tried the way of self-discovery, tasting everything that the world had to offer. And the older son was trying to find his identity by the way of moral conformity, doing everything right. The Pharisees of the day believed that they were the sons of God and they could achieve final salvation by obeying the law. And with this notion came a feeling of moral superiority. They looked down on each other. I'm an identical twin, and we're a very competitive family, to an unhealthy degree. Claire, my wife, isn't competitive at all, and she's a model of almost a freedom from the pressure of trying to compete. Because if we're competing, we're trying to get one better than the person we're competing against. But God isn't interested in competition. God is marked by compassion. And we see this vividly illustrated time and again in the gospel, in the behavior of the scribes and the Pharisees, and the behavior of the religious. Now, when I was at college in the mid-60s, we had a lovely vice principal of the college called Alan Stibbs, and he said this: "Evangelicals are very good at understanding that we are made right with God by faith, but they fall into the trap of thinking that we are made holy by trying to be good. And we end up moving from faith and grace to works and a form of legalism." And I think any form of legalism is very unattractive to the outsider. We're made for grace and freedom. Now let's get back to this picture of Rembrandt and his portrait of the elder brother. He portrays the elder brother standing on the right side of the picture. He's standing straight as a ramrod outside the circle of light around the father. The elder brother is the main observer in the prodigal's return, but he appears withdrawn and joyless as he watches the father welcoming his younger brother. Though the return is a central event on the canvas, it takes place to the left side of the picture, while the stern elder brother dominates the right. And there's a large open space between the father and the younger brother and the elder brother that creates a tension and asks for resolution. The elder brother, as Rembrandt paints him, shows many similarities with the father. Both are bearded, both wear large red cloaks over their shoulders, both have a light on their faces. But this is where the similarity ends. And returning to the whole picture, we find the father bending over the son while the elder brother remains straight as a ramrod. And that position is heightened by his staff. The father's mantle is like a tent offering his returning prodigal shelter and protection, while the elder brother's cloak hangs flat over his body. The father's hands are spread out and touch the homecomer in a gesture of welcome. while the elder brothers are clasped tightly to his chest. There's a light on both faces, but the light on the father's face flows through the whole of his body and engulfs the son in a luminous warmth, whereas the light on the elder brother's face is cold and constricted. His figure remains in the dark, showing that the son who remains at home is as lost as the returning son. The lostness of the elder brother was not so visible as that of his younger brother. When confronted, though, with the father's joy at the son's return, all the darkness bottled up within him erupts. The elder brother's words to his father reveal what's in his heart. Listen to his language as he describes the weight of a dutiful life that had become an oppressive burden on his shoulders. "Listen, all these years I have slaved for you, and you never once disobeyed your orders, yet you never offered me a kid to celebrate with my friends." He's still raging within. Now, in this scene, you've got a number of observers to the scene. One of them is the tax collector, and he's actually beating his breast. "Lord, be merciful to me, a sinner." He loves what he's seeing in this story. I gather, you've in the church, you've had some glory days in the past, and there's a longing to return to those glory days. But I don't think you will encounter God by trying to reach back into the past. Paul said, we need to let go of the past and focus on the present and God and the future. I let go of weights and I run, I press towards the mark God has for us. And so I gather, rather than seeing a new plant at the parish church as a competitor or a threat to your future, I would encourage you to thank God for bringing more people in Retford to reach thousands of lost sons and daughters. I'd encourage you to be generous in your prayers for them, that the Lord would bless and encourage them. And that'll be an answer to the prayer Jesus encouraged us to pray, that the Lord of the harvest would send labourers into the harvest. So Rembrandt, in this picture, is showing some witnesses to what's happening. And I think God will grow a church that is allowing God to change them deep within. And here in this picture, there's the tax collector. There's also a woman. Sorry, I've gone too far. A woman who's been watching what's happening. Your age profile, I don't think, will prove any barrier if you allow God to make you compassionate mothers and fathers. And some of you evidently are. Remember that Rembrandt portrays neither house nor fields. He portrays it all with darkness and light. I had a conversation over coffee with Ebony, and she had such an awareness of darkness. And when she started reading John's Gospel with her Baptist friend, she was very struck by Jesus described as the light of the world. And the darkness cannot diminish this light. Now the elder brother, turning back to him, was a part of Rembrandt's own experience. We're told he was a difficult person to get on with. Swart's biographer describes him as a bitter, vengeful person who used all permissible and impermissible ways to attack those who got in his way. He betrayed the woman who he had lived with for 6 years by getting her brother to collect evidence against her from her neighbours and having her confined to an asylum. And during this period, as I said, he was consumed with bitterness and betrayal and produced no work. Now, by the time he painted this work, both the lostness of the younger son and the elder brother were known to him. Both characters needed healing and forgiveness. Both needed to come home. Both needed the embrace of a forgiving father, and both were invited to come home because the father was waiting for them. I came across this quotation from a chap called Richard Bueller. He said, "If you've grown up in a family where approval has been confused for love, and parents have given conditions, I love you but, or I love you if, we confuse love for approval, and we spend our lives looking for approval when what we really need is love." And I recognize in my own life how important approval is. And seeking approval is no substitute from receiving love. And the father in this story loves both sons and would embrace them and invite them both to come home. So that's something about the older brother. The younger brother receives his father's welcome. Now imagine, David Watson used to use this illustration, which I think is very helpful. He said, imagine this hand represents you, and on this hand is the book representing the weight of our rebellion, our trying to get right with God by good works. And imagine this hand represents Christ. And Isaiah says, he was wounded for our transgressions, he was bruised for our iniquities, and the Lord has laid on Jesus the sin, the weight of us all. Now, what's happened to this hand representing you and me? Something's missing from it that was there before. What is it?
The weight of sin.
The weight of sin. See, Jesus took our sin upon him at the cross, and he covers us with his righteousness. God has accepted all that Christ has done on the cross for us. And I believe it's humility that says, Lord, thank you. I believe it. When you trust in Christ, God makes you right with him. You don't gain rightness with God by trying harder. We are made right with God through what Christ has done for the world on the cross. A sacrifice for sin once offered never needs to be repeated. And that's the gospel. That's good news. Let's then perhaps move into our groups again and look at these questions. What elements of the older brother syndrome can you detect in yourself? Does trying to be good give you life? How do you respond to people who receive the grace of God so easily when your life and ministry seems anything like a party? Do you ever feel God owes you something for all your efforts to serve him and others?